Paul said, "Well, why would you scourge me, a Roman citizen?" "Oh, you're a Roman citizen?" And all of a sudden, the commander was quite fearful that he could be turned in and lose his position. And Paul said, "Well, I'm not after that." But at any rate, so the commander took him into this protective custody and decided to say, "Look, this thing is way above my pay grade. I don't understand what all these Jews are arguing about. So let me go ahead and bring him to the Jewish high court, the Sanhedrin." Okay? And that's where we pick up the story today. All right? Any quick questions about that background?
I have a quick question. Maybe we talked about this last week. Can you remind me, like, what made somebody a Roman citizen versus not?
Yes. You were either born a Roman citizen by being born of a Roman father, or you could purchase it. Let's say you were a slave and you purchased your freedom. You could purchase your citizenship. And that was interesting because the soldier had actually done that. And it actually made him sort of an inferior citizen to Paul because Paul was born a Roman citizen. You know, he didn't purchase the citizenship. So that would be the way you, now again, what I do find puzzling is, did Paul have some credentials to show this, or how did he prove that? But evidently that's not in the text, but evidently there were probably some kind of papers or a stone or something that you brought around to indicate your citizenship. So anyway, without photo IDs, I don't know, you know, how do they verify these things? All right. Any other questions? All right. Now there's going to be kind of a Keystone Cops. I guess I'm showing my age here. Most of you don't even know who the Keystone Cops are, but there's a kind of a fracas that'll break out here. It's kind of humorous. And so this next little section we're going to read is kind of funny. So let's see here. I'd like to propose, though, that we're at Acts 23, but I would like to propose that we back up to the verse 30 of the previous chapter. So 22 verse 30 was where I want to begin today, okay? Anybody want to be a reader? Okay, Joy, good.
And it's just, sorry, and it's just chapter 23, verse 30, right? No, did I get that wrong?
22, verse 30, and read across the chapter break.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, 22. Okay, since he wanted to find out what Paul was accused of by the Jews, the next day he released him and ordered the chief priests and the entire council to meet. He brought Paul down and had him stand before them. While Paul was looking intently at the council, he said, "Brothers, up to this day, I have lived my life with a clear conscience before God." Then the high priest Ananias, ordered those standing near him to strike him on the mouth.
Okay, stop there. Okay. Why did he order him to be struck on the mouth? Any ideas? Okay, well, I'll supply the answer. He called them brothers. Now, this is kind of the Jewish Supreme Court. And generally, even in our own country, where we're very informal about most things, we do have our formalities, and you would never go to the Supreme Court and say brothers. or you speak to the justices by certain titles, and or like if you work in the White House, you never say, hello, Donald or Mr. Trump. You say, Mr. President, even his close friends. Inside the White House, you just never say anything other than Mr. President, okay? That's just those. So those are the kinds of things that, you know, and if someone knowingly would speak differently to, let's say, our Supreme Court justices, or to a president, or even to a Congress member. There are different titles and things that are expected to be used out of respect, not just for the person, but for the office. Okay, so you may not like the guy in the office, but you still use these these terminologies out of respect for the office. All right, now that's the seeming offense that Paul commits here. He says, brothers, okay? And I've lived my life before God in all good conscience, we see. Now, again, he was ordered to be struck on the mouth, all right? Now, Paul doesn't take that, and we'll see that in a moment. But I was going to say one other thing. I don't know why Paul addressed them as brothers. Was it wrong for Paul to do this? He seems to be looking for a fight, as you'll see in a minute, but it's hard to say. It's hard to say. I certainly am not going to sit here and accuse Paul of sin, but it is irregular to stand before people who have high offices and speak in this manner. So that's all I can say. It's the background of why he got struck on the mouth, all right? And I do think that it's puzzling. We'll leave it at that. It's puzzling why Paul addressed them that way. Instead of my fathers or...
Hello.
Yes. Oh.
Hey.
Oh, I hear somebody, but I don't... Okay, I better mute there. Okay, good. Okay. So we have a... let's go on then, Joy, and read from verse 3 and following.
At this, Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting there to judge me according to the law, and yet in violation of the law, you order me to be struck? Those standing nearby said, do you dare to insult God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not realize, brothers, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a leader of your people.
Okay. Now, again, there's a mystery here. I mean, how could Paul not know? I mean, if anybody were to go into the Supreme Court today, they might not know the exact person, but they could probably pretty quickly identify who was the you know, they were all Supreme Court justices, but also that, who was the, who's the highest justice? The Grand Poobah Justice.
Chief Justice.
Chief Justice. Yeah, there you go. but again, you have to wonder. But even still, I mean, the simple fact of reviling a member of the Jewish High Court in this way is surprising. But on the other hand, he does accuse them of violating the law, right? So in other words, you're going to invoke the law on me, but you break the law by ordering a fellow Jew to be struck, something you have no right to do. But you remember how Jesus got struck, right? Remember the same thing? I hate to say it, but, there is kind of a, and I know some of you work in and through in the Congress and all, but I guess it's kind of true, isn't it, that a lot of Congress people are famous for passing laws that they don't think they have to follow. And we see this very often. Recently with mask wearing, but other things, something far more important, even laws like, rules for insurance and hiring practices that everyone else is required to follow. But in the Congress there, they just kind of waive these rules for themselves. So it's a very troublesome thing. So it's not, but you can see there is nothing new under the sun, right? All right. So he calls him a whitewashed wall. Remember how Jesus referred to some of the religious as whitewashed tombs. By the way, maybe I should take this moment to sort of maybe mention a kind of a theme in Acts, that you'll find that most of what Jesus goes through, members of the early church go through. You see here a lot of echoes of Jesus' trial, don't you? Being struck. You see also the language of whitewashed tombs or whitewashed wall in this case. We see these images that you'll also notice that Paul will have a double enemy that he faces. The Romans combined with Jewish cooperators. The Jews turn him over and the Romans do the punishing. Same thing with Jesus, right? A lot of Jewish collaborators turned against him, turned him over to the Romans, and Jesus suffered and died. So it's the double beast of the beast from the land and the beast from the sea. The beast from the sea was a symbol of the Gentiles, and the beast from the land, i.e. the promised land, is from the fellow Jews. So this is the great red dragon gave birth to two beasts, and these two beasts persecuted the early church. Very frequently, fellow Jews would hand Christians over, and the Romans would do the punishing. See, and this was a very so you see a lot of parallels here. All right, Joe, you want to pick up with he admits that he himself has done something here. You should not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Mm-hmm. So he sort of admits this, right? But accuses them, the charge still stands, that they also broke the law by striking a fellow Jew. Okay, verse 6.
When Paul noticed that some were Sadducees and others were Pharisees, he called out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. I am on trial concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead." When he said this, a dissension began between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say there is no resurrection or angel or spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge all three. Then a great clamor arose, and certain scribes of the Pharisees group stood up and contended, "We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" When the dissension became violent, the tribune, fearing that they would tear Paul to pieces, ordered the soldiers to go down, take him by force, and bring him into the barracks. That night, the Lord stood near him and said, "Keep up your courage, for just as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, you must bear witness, so you must bear witness also in Rome."
Okay. And this is what I meant earlier by the kind of silly, kind of Keystone Cops. The Keystone Cops was actually a very old series. But there would be just this total chaos where everybody's hitting everybody, and it's just it was a typical Keystone Cop scene. And it's just very funny because Paul basically just lobs a hot potato into this group, and they all start screaming and hollering at each other because the Sadducees and the Pharisees didn't agree on much, but they knew this Jesus guy was trouble and he had to go, and so did his disciples. So Paul decides to exploit their differences, and he says, "Well, I'm on trial for the resurrection of the dead." And the Pharisees accept the resurrection of the dead at least one day, and the Sadducees say, "No, you just when you die, you die." And they were very divided groups. You know, we think all the Jews thought alike and they all had the same faith. They really didn't. The Sadducees only accepted the first five books of the Bible, and the Pharisees accepted all the books, the Ketuvim, the Nevi'im, and the Paravim. And so we had all three, the law, the prophets, and the Pentateuch. So they accepted the whole, what we call Old Testament, whereas the Sadducees rejected everything but the first five books of the Bible. And they claimed that in the first five books of the Bible, there was no mention of angels, of resurrection from the dead, and so on. And yet, some of that's patently untrue. For example, in Exodus, there's mention of an angel. Likewise, we see the Jesus proves the resurrection of the dead with the Sadducees by saying, God calls himself the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But they were long ago dead, 400 years before him. If he's a God of the only of the living and not of the dead, how could he call himself that? And they didn't know how to answer. So the point being that this really got the two groups fighting with each other. And Paul just sort of stepped back and watched them all fight. And it's so awful. It's so violent that, the commander has to rescue Paul and pull him out of this fracas. And bring him back into the Antonia fortress. So, I mean, you can almost see Paul kind of with his tongue in his cheek. "Hey, I'm on trial for believing in the resurrection of the dead." "What? Well, we believe in that." "No, we don't believe in that." And then they go at each other. So I hope you see the humor in it. Okay. It's a funny scene. All right. Now we have here, you know, by the way, is that just a caricature? I mean, no, people were very passionate about their religion in the ancient world in a way that people are not today. "Well, if that's your boat, man, and it floats your boat, go ahead and, you know, believe that, man." And, you know, it's all kind of, things are sort of vague and fuzzy and up for grabs. And you see, we tend to trivialize the human person today. We say, look, it doesn't really matter what a person believes, just so long as they behave well. You know, they don't beat their wife and they pay their taxes. You know, and that trivializes a human person. We were made to know the truth, and the truth sets us free. And so, to simply dismiss whole walks of people who don't know Christ and just say, well, that's just not their thing. You know, if Buddhism floats your boat, go for it. If you like this, God within movement and Deepak Chopra, you go for that. It sounds like we're respecting and being tolerant, but in effect, I contend we're trivializing the human person, because they were made to know the truth, and Jesus is the truth. And we shouldn't ridicule their beliefs, but we should also try our very best to get them to come to the full truth, who is Jesus. So, all right. So, but people in the ancient world were very different from this. There was no blasé attitude. There were wars and many riots, even among Christians, over, like, for example, on the divinity of Christ. When Arius came into town and preached against the divinity of Christ, there was a riot that went on for several days. People were very serious about this stuff, and in ways that we are often not, you know. Oh, how many angels dance on the head of a pin? What do you care about? Don't sweat the small stuff, you know. And we seem to have a kind of a blasé attitude. So just compare and contrast. Now, I think in our time, there's a certain value of tolerance in a very pluralistic culture, right? But I do think that we have to be better within the church about policing, if you will, dissent, and making clear that it is not what the church teaches, and insisting that those who, especially if they're priests or even lay people who claim, you know, their Catholic status and then speak erroneously regarding the faith, that they should be publicly corrected by the bishops. And people like priests and others, if they won't desist, they should have their faculty to preach and teach removed. Now, that happened finally with Charles Curran at Catholic University after many decades of dissenting teaching. And it took too long, I thought, but it does still happen, but it's rare today. And I would say that without becoming who's that guy in the 50s? Without becoming McCarthy-like, we would want to be, I think, a little firmer and clearer and disciplined, especially priests or bishops who mislead the faithful, okay? So, all right. So to try to find in our culture a sweet spot there is important. Okay, now it goes on to say here that, so we see this terrible fracas that breaks out. Now then, we have this little line where the following night the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage, for you, as you have testified about the facts of me in Jerusalem, you must also testify in Rome." Now this, did the Lord actually appear to him as an apparition, or was it just something within his heart that he felt? It's not clear. Okay, so I often talk to you about what I hear. Well, the Lord said to me one day, blah, 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 blah. And you know, to take me, I'm not saying I heard a voice through the plaster ceiling. I'm speaking that there's an infused knowledge that can come to one where you're pretty sure it's the Lord's voice. You may not be 100% sure, but it makes some sense. Based on the fact that I wouldn't have necessarily answered it this way or that way. And so there's a kind of an infused sense that the Lord has spoken and answered me. You know, it's funny, I'll sit there in the chapel and ask the Lord a question and I don't get any answer. And I'm walking into Safeway and boom, the answer pops in. You know, the Lord's timing isn't always ours. It's kind of an odd experience, you know, you're sitting in a meeting and all of a sudden, boom, the answer comes, or you're walking into Safeway or something, and there it is, you know. It says, okay, Lord. Okay, I got the answer. But anyway, all that's just a way of saying, so we don't know that it was just another apparition, or just, again, Paul had a good sense of the Lord speaking to him in his heart, okay? All right, now we want to find out what happens next. There's a plot to kill Paul, so we have to relocate him. So you want to read on, Joy?
In the morning, the Jews joined in a conspiracy and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who joined in this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food until we have killed Paul." Now then, you and the council must notify the tribune to bring him down to you on the pretext that you want to make a more thorough examination of his case, and we are ready to do away with him before he arrives. Now the son of Paul's sister heard about the ambush, so he went and gained entrance to the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to report to him. So he took him, brought him to the tribune, and said, the prisoner Paul called me and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to tell you. The tribune took him by the hand and drew him aside privately and asked, what is it that you have to report to me? He answered, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more thoroughly into his case. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him. They have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink until they kill him. They are ready now and waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, ordering him, tell no one that you have informed me of this.
Okay, now this will lead to Paul being relocated to keep him in a safer spot. With that in mind, would you see the kind of overreach? They're almost deranged. And I got to think the centurion or the commander here must say, good heavens, you know, what has this guy done? Why do so many people hate him? I mean, it's just overkill, a kind of a derangement. And so there is this puzzlement I'm sure he must have. But let's talk about this for a minute. This real derangement. So when we one of the things I have always found strangely consoling is why there is such a special hatred for the Catholic Church. You know, I know of no other, other than the Jews, historically, I know of no other religion that has been so hated, so despised, and so opposed, especially in the modern age as we become more secular. I mean, they don't have their targets on the Episcopalians or the Methodists or the Muslims or the, even at this time, the Jews, at least in terms of their religious views. Why such a hatred for the Catholic Church? I mean, we're not even all that powerful anymore. Where our numbers have dropped and we're almost public enemy number one to the secularists. And what's that all about, see? And I find it strangely consoling. You know, there's an old saying, when you're getting a lot of flack, you're over the target. You know, but I will tell you, my theory is that first and foremost, the devil is the prince of this world, and he has a special hatred for the Catholic Church because he knows that it is the church founded by Jesus Christ, the true church, and that we have a role to play ultimately in the historical demise of the devil's kingdom. He hates the church, and he inspires special hatred for the Catholic Church. Further, of course, you know, if you just look at a sociological dimension, we do, at least in terms of our official teachings, oppose much of the secularist agenda. You name it, all the big moral issues today, we weigh in on these things, and we have a different view. Which, you know, every now and again, I'll get into somebody will approach me, and whether they're, you know, kind of kind, but opposed, or sometimes they're just fierce, and they just say, you know, your church is a bigoted, hateful institution, and I can't stand it. You should be ashamed to be wearing those clothes. And I think to myself, you know, I'm just some dude. And the Catholic Church is just one institution among millions of institutions in the world. We have some influence and power historically, but we're not really that organized or even agreed among ourselves very well. And yet there's just this, the Catholic Church, you know, and there's a special hatred. So first of all, do you perceive this? And would you agree that this is, you know, or do you think that you have some ideas of why the hatred is so pronounced? Again, given our limited power, you're trying to force your values on me. You say, I have no power to force anything on you. You're trying to force your values. Well, how would I do that? You're doing a pretty good job of saying, heck no. All right. So any thoughts or comments you have on this? Because, you know, Paul's experiencing this, but we sort of experience this in a more collective way.
Right. So I think it goes back to, when I was reading Brothers Karamazov and Ivan, who's like, you know, has deep criticisms of religion and orthodoxy. Of course, it's in Russia, so it's Russian orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he goes to a criticism based on the idea of being an independent thinker. He says, you know, I'm an independent thinker. I know hurting children is wrong. I know these things. I don't need an institution to tell me. So I think that there's this like pervasive, and I think that's kind of like just an example of this pervasive idea that people who are independent thinkers can construct this moral relativistic idea of what is truth, what is good themselves. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's subjective to every situation. They view it as, I mean, they just view it as a lesser to be a part of an institution that's prescribing and telling you what you believe. Hmm. You can't be intelligent. You can't be a free thinking human and you can't construct your own morality if you have to be told that hurting a child is wrong, to be told that murder is wrong. So it seems to me that people are just kind of in this meta sphere where they think that they're just beyond religion because they can construct morality themselves and don't need to be told what is right and what is wrong. That makes any sense. I've just seen that so many times in books and literature, and I've just seen my own friends who have walked away. And it seems to be a very pervasive idea within a lot of spheres of society. So just my two cents.
I think kind of going along with what you said, when you listen to that, it sounds like that sort of comportment really comes from like a spirit of pride. And it's something I think we all have. We all have our flesh, but you also are influenced by evil. And I think that's the hard thing is that, you know, I talk with people who really respect our work and who are really intelligent. And they're wonderful people. They're well-mannered, well-formed. But also they, like, I've noticed that people tend to kind of scoff when anything like faith is kind of put to the table, or just kind of, you know, having this, and I say this like really caring about these people, there tends to be kind of this arrogance that, you know, you can do it yourself and this self-sufficiency. And, you know, those things aren't from God. So I tend to view kind of like more almost like in a spiritual sense, like what is going on with these people? What sort of like attitude or demeanor are they showing? So that can be one thing too. The other thing I found interesting and honestly kind of frustrating is seeing how certain values that come as fruits of the spirit, you know, kindness, gentleness, self-discipline, fear of the Lord, like these sort of things, these sort of values, are really like diminished in society. It's really, you know, frustrating when like the value that might be most like taken to the most like valued could be given this abrasiveness or this like control and all these things. So there tends to be not, it's not just you know, the church is trying to teach us to be these ways, but I think sometimes like people tend to scoff at people who in general have this sort of desire to possess these traits, and they'll kind of put that off as like naivety or just like foolishness. So that really, I think, drives home the fact that the wisdom of the world is really the true foolishness, but tell that to anyone in the world and they're just going to view it as wisdom. So anyways, those have been like kind of the contradictory values that I've seen, like as Christians we should have, and what has been kind of against that in the world. And then kind of understanding as well from a spiritual sense, oh, well, we do have these tendencies towards sin. We all have them. So these people who are acting arrogantly or seem to be acting like they're acting pridefully or something, it makes sense why why they are that way doesn't mean it's right, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I would like to maybe just make a couple remarks based on your remarks, both of you. First of all, I think the distrust of institutions, especially religious institutions, is a big sociological phenomenon. But there's something specially reserved for the Catholic Church. And so that it doesn't quite get to that issue. I think there's generally, that explains why a lot of people have fallen away from the practice of the faith. But I'm not talking about that so much as this intense focus and special hatred reserved for the Catholic Church. Look, you want to say something, Amelia, right?
Right. Something I've heard by a few, some of my siblings that have walked away from the faith, they view the Catholic Church as very archaic and very slow to reform. So they brought up, my brother brought up Judaism. You know, you have Orthodoxy, conservative Jews, then now we have Reformed, which of course some people reject of Reform. Then you also have, you know, some Likud Jews. You know, there's various forms, right, of Judaism. And that came about based on like cultural shifts and norms. And so in some people's minds, the church is too slow to form or to conform, I guess, to the social values of the context of time. And like the Jewish faith, for example, you know, has done that. And I've heard that many times as an example by people as well, specifically the Catholic Church. You know,
because no, I can see that,
you know, within denominations like Episcopal, they slowly just kind of went off.
Yeah, I could see that with a maybe someone who leaves the Catholic Church. But as far as non-Catholic, why do they care that we're slow or that we're old-fashioned? Why do they care? Yeah, I mean, do they care that the Odd Fellows still follow old traditions at the local Odd Fellows Hall? I don't know. I mean, anyway, but okay. But I can certainly see that from someone who's in the church who doesn't think the church is changing enough or conforming with the culture.
So, you know, we've all been to confession, hopefully, and we've all had people kind of tell us things that we don't want to hear, those hard truths. And it's not fun. You know, you don't like people like necessarily correcting you or telling you you have to like build, you know, grow. But I think that's a sign of truth. And I think that's what the Catholic Church does. You know, it tells you those hard truths about yourself, things that you need to kind of grow in. And I think that for people who don't know how to receive certain truths in love and don't have faith, it's going to be painful to hear. Yeah. But you want to hear the truth because it's going to help you to grow. So I think that's what it is. I think there's just that there is truth there and people aren't prepared to receive it. And I think that's a sign of the Catholic Church being true, at least for me. Because I'd rather people be like, you know, I'd rather honesty and directness and frankness, all synonyms of each other. But like, even if it isn't like, you know, what I want to hear, because that helps you to kind of like grow and build virtue. But that's not what people are about now, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah. I see Mike has his hand up.
Yeah. For the question on the why the church is being hated so much today, and I don't know, for me, it's not so much an intelligent answer. It's going to be pretty elementary. But like to me, it's just by extension of Jesus, since he was so hated, like it makes sense to go choose Barabbas, right? But he, like, and Jesus was innocent. So just by extension of like the mystical body of Christ or the church being the bride of Christ, just by extension that if Jesus was hated so much that his church would be hated too by extension is what I was always thinking.
Yeah. Again, yeah, and I think that would be the, essential, yes, that Satan somehow perceives it is truly the body of Christ, and yeah, it's great, archenemy.
Monsignor, can I jump in really quick?
Oh, yeah, who's that, Stephen?
Drew, sorry, my camera's not working, but in terms of, you know, why do people dislike the Catholic Church, so when I lived in the UK and the Netherlands for 5 years, two countries where the Catholic Church hasn't had a major presence since the Reformation. And in the UK, I mean, the Catholics were openly persecuted, and there were laws in place to prevent them from voting, from kind of, there were kind of societal norms that, you know, prevented Catholics from holding kind of esteemed places in society. And that, like, up until really recently, that's been the norm. And I think particularly it's less true in the Netherlands, just because there's a different religious, there's a different religious culture there. But in the UK, like, a lot of people view the Catholic Church as this big, centralized, archaic, foreign institution. And for a lot of people in the UK, they viewed the Catholic Church in the same boat as some of the country's foreign enemies. So like France and Spain, in particular. And then I think a lot of American Protestants kind of inherited these views. I mean, I remember seeing a cartoon that was done by the Ku Klux Klan of a Klansman blocking the way of, you know, foreign Catholicism to the American shores. And the Catholic Church was depicted as, I believe it was St. Patrick, who was representing the church. So I think, like, non-Catholics have this idea that it's this kind of big, scary, centralized, massive institution. And even, like, there's probably, for many people, it's, you know, the fact that it's a foreign institution too. That's maybe a little less true, at least in the US these days, but I know, like, particularly 50 years ago, that was still definitely a factor, because they viewed the Catholic Church as, you know, something that, you know, only, you know, like, Irish and Italian or Central European immigrants were doing, and not kind of real, not something, you know, quote unquote, real Americans took part in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some of these are, you know, like I say, sociological, historical things, but.
And I apologize for earlier. I kept getting booted off it for some reason. But if no one had mentioned, I don't know if anyone mentioned this about the unknown. There's so much that's unknown that we must believe regardless of whether it's there or not. For instance, we know that we're receiving Jesus, but in our other faiths, it's all symbolic. One of the things in some of my coursework at American U was, when you look at the podium, that's made of wood, but it's still wood. And it's like the transubstantiation, when that host goes through that process and becomes Jesus, we've accepted that podium being a podium, but it's still wood. Mm-hmm. So our belief in the unknown is really baffling to people. And beyond what they can see, feel, touch, that's could possibly be. I don't know if anyone mentioned that before.
Okay. Can I hop in as a final point? sorry, I'm in my garage. I was just cleaning my bike, but listening to all this. But, you know, Father, you said that, you know, it's not like we're a major powerhouse in this country, but I think we are in a lot of ways, because 1 in 5 people in America are Catholic. Now you can go into what, unfortunately, I have to say this, but what level, how, you know, serious they are about their faith, but at least they claim to be Catholic. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at the secular world around the world, and not just in America, I think what, you know, the Catholic Church stands for is very scary to what true secularism is, and what they stand for, you know. And I think in America itself, especially when you look at the way our country is founded, you know, the First Amendment freedom of religion is so important and intrinsic. And I think the Catholic Church is one of the predominant powerhouses in the world for teaching. And I think when you look at, you know, what is important right now, it's not just winning the cultural war, you know, currently it's teaching the next generation. And I think the Catholic Church draws a lot of criticism because we do have a code that we follow, a law that we follow, where right now what is popular, what is accepted is do whatever you want, however you feel, so long as it's right. And we aspire to a higher truth than that. And so mm-hmm. I think because of that, because of our ability to teach others and position throughout schools, whatever it may be, puts Catholics at a higher position to be targeted.
Monsignor, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I listen sometimes to Gus Lloyd on the Sirius XM. And this morning he spoke of the Pope's encyclical and how it has in some ways appeared to modify some things that we as Catholics should be believing, and there are some Catholics that disagree with that. Do you think that people believe that the Pope is kind of succumbing to the norms?
Well, I have not read the encyclical or even any reviews of it yet, so I need to be, you know, clear about that. I do think that this Pope has been this Pope has been somewhat famous for kind of redefining things and a little weaponized ambiguity. And I think generally he also has a fairly globalist outlook, which is troubling to some. And you know, I'm among those who are I'm rather troubled by it, because I think it violates subsidiarity, and I think that nations, there's a certain special patriotism that's part of the fourth commandment we should foster. Anyway, I don't have time to go through. I'm talking about so I don't know exactly what he's written. I heard it was just signed yesterday, and the idea too, I think I have heard is that the idea of the brotherhood of everyone is a nice idea, but we can't allow that to simply gloss over the differences that are significant that we should note. So if something can't be true, A can't be true, and not A can't also be true. I mean, there's a real issue that has to be resolved there. And just saying, well, we're all brothers might kind of gloss over some of that. So I think that'd be the only thing I can say, not having really read it yet. And, you know, it's on my stack of stuff. And so we'll
see. Well, the focus was about St. Francis of Assisi in that regard, but there was a mention that there were some things that were, I just wanted to know if you were familiar. So I'll wait until you read it and would love to hear your point of view.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's get on with the story here. Let's get Paul at least into chapter 24. So, Joy, why don't we pick up with verse 23.
Okay. Then he summoned two of the centurions and said, "Get ready to leave by 9 o'clock tonight for Caesarea with 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen."
Now, just also, stop for a second. It's just not getting crazy. All this to accompany Paul. But this guy's seeing all these fracases, riots, fist fights. You know? So I didn't mean to interrupt you, Joy, but it's remarkable, isn't it? I mean, the overkill. You know, all this to take one guy, you know, to Caesarea. But anyway, like I said, the Romans were very, very hawkish about avoiding riots and civil unrest. And if 40 men have decided they want to take an oath to kill this guy, it's going to be, so he's going to make sure. So a whole Roman garrison is going out to take Paul. Pretty impressive. Okay, why don't you start again? Oh, go ahead, Joy.
Okay. Also, it's not very effective for the 40 guys who are going to go try to kill him to like not eat or drink. I just have to say, like, I get the sentiment, but it's not efficient.
They might not be strong. Yeah.
Okay. So then he summoned two of the centurions and said, "Get ready to leave by 9 o'clock tonight for Caesarea with 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and take him safely to Felix, the governor." He wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias to His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. But when I had learned that he was a Roman citizen, I came with the guard and rescued him. Since I wanted to know the charge for which they accused him, I had brought him to their council. I found that he was accused concerning questions of the law, but was charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him during the night to Antipatris. The next day, they let the horsemen go on with him, while they returned to the barracks. When they came to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he belonged to, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, 'I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive.' Then he ordered that he be kept under guard in Herod's headquarters."
Okay. Now, I mean, 470 soldiers to, that's pretty, I wonder what Felix and Antipatris, who's one of the Herodians, thought about all this. You know, who's this guy Paul? he must be quite an escape artist or something. But it's a very thing. Now, it's interesting that the centurion, the commander, writes to the governor, Felix, and says, you know, it is kind of interesting to see these things from the outside, isn't it? He's being accused of certain violations of their law, but nothing that seems to be deserving of death or imprisonment. So all these inside baseball disputes between Jews, Jewish Christians, and Christians, and these things seem to the Romans a lot to do about nothing. There's no fight like a family fight, you know. And some of the worst fights occur in those kinds of settings. But it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's a mention by the Emperor Claudius, who remarks, not Josephus. Yeah, I think it's according to, I'm forgetting the author, another Roman author, but Claudius made some remark that these Christians seem to be a sect of the Jews who claim that a certain Christ was killed but now is alive, and you know, just kind of described very blasé like that, and yet these are things that have launched a faith of over 2,000 years now. And so as I say, here are these Roman officials seemingly unaware that a life-changing event has happened that is utterly going to rock the world, and it'll never be the same. Namely, that Jesus Christ is King, and there will be soon enough the Roman Empire will officially embrace Christianity. And as I say, this is just a completely, but they're like, well, there seems to be some disputes among these Jews about certain doctrines, about a guy who died and apparently came back to life, or is now reported as living, and I don't know what it's really all about, but let's get on to something more important. What kind of pasta are we going to have tonight? Will it be the fettuccine, or will it be the spaghetti? I can put it kind of in a comical way, you know. I often think that the officials in Rome, you know, we Americans love to ask questions about the law because we're very litigious, we Americans, and the Romans aren't. If you go to Rome today, you know, it says all trucks stay off the Autobahn or the highway. And then when you get on the highway, it says all trucks stay to the right. It's a Roman notion of law. Anyway, so these Americans, we write all the time. Is this allowed? Is that allowed? Under what circumstances? And can you clarify this? And the Roman curate, these Americans. You know, I tell you, I do not know. Let us give them an answer. What should we say? Let's say no. How about that? That sounds good. Tell them no. Now, again, what type of sauce will we have should it be Alfredo or should it be marinara? You know, I mean, yeah. And they get on to more important things. Anyway, just a way of saying that, isn't it amazing how life-changing these things are, and yet those in charge who have all the power seem to be completely unaware of what's happening right under their feet, right? And never forget that may be true today too. And again, most of us who live in D.C., we're part of the power structure. We're inside the bubble, and yet there may be somebody who was just recently born who's going to change the world for better or worse. But or there may be movements and things going on of which the people in power have no clue yet of how influential it's going to be for better or worse. So I would just simply say we have to have a lot of humility. And what is God up to right now? How will God pull, what will happen? Will this nation and everything, the West as we know, completely collapse and be replaced? Empires have come and gone in the age of the church. Or will God somehow suddenly pull us like a brand out of the fire and bring us a great religious revival? I don't know, but God does. And we have to have a lot more humility. And we may be dismissive of something that we see. What happened recently? The Supreme Court justice, the people of praise. All of a sudden, this is some huge thing. And anyway, they had not a clue what they were talking about. You know, there were all these weird things. You want to say something, Amelia?
I grew up in the people of praise, so I mean,
you're one of them.
I mean,
what are you up to?
We know her pretty well. Yeah. Wonderful family.
Right.
It's not the way New York Times described it. Wall Street Journal actually did a pretty good article that spoke mm-hmm. to the community yeah. fairly well. But so I mean,
Very
people just don't understand the idea in this very individualistic culture and world we live in, the idea of making a covenant commitment to a community. But it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I grew up with a robust community where we had a revolving door. People came in and out. Like, nothing was my own. I just learned to share from a young age. And I mean, it was living out acts, and it was beautiful. Honestly, it was beautiful. But again, it's not going to make sense to people, and they're going to criticize it. And I mean, what do you want to do? Live a lonely life and be inside and watch TV? I mean, it's much better to live a life with people and have family and just what's wrong with that?
There must be something wrong because the media says so. But anyway, my point is that those in power tend to either overestimate the threat or underestimate, but they seldom get it right. So I'm trying to show you both ends of the spectrum. There's often a lot of just crazed concern about this or that thing, and it's no big deal. And then sometimes there isn't any attention paid to things that are far more pernicious, you know. And so, as I say, the media sometimes is powerful, and what it doesn't report is what it reports. So, yeah. Well, all right. Now we've gotten Paul into 26. I think we'll wrap it up for tonight. But I just want you to see that there's really, in some sense, a lot of humor if you have eyes to see it. 470 troops. Really four centurions are sent out. They each have 100 under their to take this one guy, Paul, 40 miles to Caesarea, you know. And then all the silliness of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, you know, practically, you know, tearing each other to pieces, all these kinds of things. There's a little bit of, don't miss some of the humor in this. It just makes you laugh a little, okay? So, all right. Any final comments or questions? Joy, could you, I'm gonna just say one more time, because a lot of people have come on board since we were talking, but next Monday at 4:30, we're invited over to the John Paul Center to so for some wine and cheese. And then at 5 o'clock, we'll go on the air with WMET, the EWT affiliate here. And I will moderate along with one of the EWTN staff, a discussion about certain topics. There'll be four segments. It'll all be done within an hour. We'll be done by six. But we'll have opportunities to maybe have some thoughts from you all on certain topics. And just, we're looking for to bring as many, about 12 of us. And I think, I forget, Joy, how many, you said we need some more men though.
We do. I think we have like one guy for certain, and maybe one, and then maybe another one. So maybe three. But they did ask for it to be balanced, you know, just to be fair. And then it has to be, what's it called? It has to be, like 12 people at most, or not at most, 14 people. So yeah, basically, other people can participate by being like at home, or, and just texting questions in and doing it that way.
Listening on the air. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how many do we have now?
We probably have seven for certain, maybe eight. But yeah, so here, I'm going to look at my list of people. I have 10 total down, but not everyone is 100% yet. So I think like seven is the number we have for certain. So we definitely need some more people.
So if you don't know Joy's email, you just email me, and or Amelia, I guess you might have hers because you sent out the flock note or what have you. But if you don't have Joy's email, but let's try to, you know, if you could plan to come, it would be very helpful because we're trying to launch an initiative with the radio station. Yeah, so it would be helpful if you can come and you get some wine and cheese. So, all right. Well, listen, thanks for your patience. I mean, I thought that we should have a couple discussions about these topics because they remain, I think, interesting ones for us today, even though they're ancient. So if you think you have a new idea, go back and see how the Greeks put it, right? So nothing new under the sun. These patterns repeat. But nevertheless, you know, they have sometimes unique qualities of the way they pan out in a particular time and place. And so I just like to see how, connect some dots with our own cultural experiences. So thanks for participating. All right, the Lord be with you. And may Almighty God bless you all, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you all for being here. And by the way, we are going to continue to work on that possibility of bringing some people back in the room together. But we'll work out the technical stuff, Amelia, and we'll, you know, okay, great. See you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.